Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
I think it's recording. I hope it's recording. I hope it's recording. Good. Well, then, you know what? We're going. Dale, motherfucking Comstock, back in the saddle for American Badass Volume 6. Dale is in his home right now. His Wi-Fi is fucked up. And right now we're having a little bit of like a time delay lag. So what I'm going to, I have found a good way to deal with lag before with guests, and it's for me to just shut the fuck up so that there's no, like, I say something, you pause, and you pause. So if I have something to say, I'll just hold up my finger, and I'll basically raise my hand, and then Dale, the teacher, will call on my dumbass. But for right now, I'm going to shut up, and I'm going to hand it over to Dale so that we don't play this so we don't play this game of delay tag, and it's a headache for everybody, and it makes you want to fucking blow your brains out. So I'm going to shut up, and if I have to talk, I'll raise my hand. But as of right now, Dale Comstock, American Badass, Volume 6. The book will be linked in the description, sticky in the top comment. Dale, it's all yours.
All right, brother. Appreciate it, man. So picking up where we left off, so for any new listeners or viewers that are watching, listening to this podcast, where am I calling from? I'm calling from Bali, Indonesia. So yeah, I actually live in Bali. How cool is that? I have a home in Florida, but I spend the majority of my time here in Bali. I have a business here with my wife and I. We have a security business. Actually, my wife just started a fish farm. She's going to be a fish farmer on top of everything else, which is kind of cool. And so this is where I'm at. I'm calling from my villa. Normally, I call from my office, but the power went out in that area. So we got a lot of thunderstorms coming in this time of year. It's the rainy season. So so I opted to come home and do it here from the villa. And the Wi-Fi is kind of sketchy because I'm on actually using my wife's cell phone for the Wi-Fi connection. So anyways, continue on today. So, oh yeah, one more thing, you know, again, for the new listeners out there, if you want to go back, if you want to know more about my background and who the hell am I, you know, go back to like the episode 1, volume 1, and we talk a little bit about my background, so you'll know a little bit more about who I am. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to continue on with my book, American Badass. And by the way, it's not about being a badass. It's actually about being a good ass. I've actually been thrown under the bus for that by some of my friends that never read the book, right? So don't judge a book by the cover. And the book design was actually deliberate for many reasons. One, I wanted it to kind of like, I wanted to get people's attention, especially chicks. No. but you know, it looks like, you know, this is a story about a guy that's in prison. He's got a chain around him, and he's naked, whatever. But it's more than that. In American Badass, it's not about being a badass. It really is about being a good ass. So that's why I tell everybody, that's never read the book, if you read it, you'll find that I use my life stories to, I've threaded a moral in there, a story about, you know, righteousness, doing the right thing, being a good, you know, a good father, a good citizen, a good patriot, a good American, all those things, right? So that's tied into the book. And that's really, that was my intent when I wrote the book. Although it's not a biography, it wasn't designed or written to be all about me as much as it's designed to be, you know, or written to be about you. And there's a message in there for people to hopefully be inspired and to better themselves. So with that said, last week we talked about the raid on Modelo prison. We went through that. So today what I want to do is actually, I'm going to move back. I actually skipped over a chapter, so I'm going to step back one chapter, and I'm going to talk about Special Forces Green Berets. And so with that said, while I was in Delta Force, you know, I was a team. Originally, when I got there, I was a breacher, right? My job was as an assaulter, and also I had the responsibility of doing all the ballistic, explosive, mechanical, and manual breaching and ballistic breaching, right? So that was my job as part of the team. But I was still an assaulter And, you know, it was one of my additional duties, which I was happy to do that, right? I learned a lot about explosives. I've been working with explosives for about 35 years in many capacities. So while I was in Delta Force, after I was there about 3 years, I had an opportunity to go to the Special Forces Qualification Course. And so a lot of us in Delta actually went through the Q course because a lot of us didn't have that MOS, right? That MOS designator. And what was happening was we were now competing against our peer group in the regular Army, and our mission, our duties were classified. So the promotion boards really didn't have an understanding of what a guy like me was doing in my rank with my original MOS, right? So we were getting passed over for promotions because we were just some gray man in some gray unit, right? And when the promotion boards for that particular MOS convened, you know, they picked the best guys that stood out, that they could actually read their background, their bios, and go, okay, this is what this guy did. Whereas we were like, everything was classified, right? So that kind of bit us in the butt. So the theory was, okay, let's start sending our operators to some of these schools so they get the MOS designated. Like, for example, I got 18 Bravo, which is light and heavy weapons sergeant for special forces. And now what that meant was when I was eligible for promotion, now I could go into the same pool as the other Green Berets and be competitive with them, right? So that was the whole theory behind it. And I was grateful to go because, to be honest with you, when I got to the unit, as I mentioned last time, I was the youngest operator ever selected at the age 23, when the average age was 33. So I didn't have a lot of skills and experience, right? I spent 4 years in 82nd. I was an infantryman in a long-range scout and a rifle company, you know, and that was it. And I decided to reenlist and go for the gusto, right? Go for the top, be a Delta Force operator. So I was very fortunate to even make it and get selected. But when I got to the unit, I wasn't unprepared, but I was woefully inexperienced compared to the other guys that had 10 years of experience on me, right? So I was happy to go to the Q course, to be a Green Beret, to pick up that additional, you know, the skill sets that I learned and the additional skill qualifier. So from there, I came out as the light and heavy weapons expert. And then I went back to the unit, right? So we talked about that last time. So let's talk about my experience going through the Q course, which is actually quite interesting. It's 6 months long, and back when I went through, you know, I don't know what it's like today, but it was pretty grueling back then, right? You know, we would get up every morning, 6 o'clock PT. You know, we had a guy named Sergeant Golab, that Sergeant First Class Golab. He ran the PT, the physical fitness training, in the morning. And that guy was actually a big guy and could run like a gazelle. And he would run every morning like his hair was on fire. And I think he actually tried to run so hard that we would all fall out. And then, you know, and if we didn't fall out, when we got to finish the run, which could be any length of, you know, any distance, he usually punished us with a lot of push-ups and sit-ups and other calisthenics. So PT was very grueling every morning. The entire course was very challenging for many reasons. You know, you have different phases in the course, and one of the phases that you go through, and they keep moving the phases around, you know, but basically the phase that I went through was where I learned my MOS, my new MOS, which was weapons, light and heavy weapons. And then the third phase, the last phase, was actually the phase where we go out in the field and we do field operations. And now you perform your duties with your MOS as part of a coherent team, right? As a group on a notional special forces mission, right? So if you follow the special forces training, it's out there on the internet, you'll know that the training's conducted up in the URE Forest of North Carolina, also out in Southern Pines, place called Big. It's a notional country called Pineland, and it's pretty cool, right? We do our UW foreign and our FID missions out there, which is unconventional warfare and foreign internal defense, UW FID, and so. It's It's very interesting, but it wasn't easy, and it seemed like it was extra hard for me because what happened to me was right when I started the Q course. Now, as I mentioned before, you know, I've been married many times, right? And so that's kind of that kind of goes along with the MOS. If you're ever considering going to Special Forces, remember that, you know, it's almost SOP. You have to have at least one divorce, right? Maybe two. I've had more than that. And I'm kind of ashamed to say that, but on the other hand, I've got a pretty good alibi because when you're never around, it's kind of hard to keep a marriage together, right? So, but anyways, so going through the Q course, I'll just cut to the chase. My wife, one of my ex-wives, decided that she wanted to see somebody else and wanted to leave me. And I didn't know that was happening. And then when it happened, she actually left, and I was left with my son, who was 18 months old at the time. And so here I am in the morning, getting up at 4:30 in the morning to get ready to go to the Q course for PT. I got my 18-year-old son or 18-month-old son. I've got to, you know, find a babysitter for him and drop him off, and then you know, go through the course all day, and then, you know, in the evening come home, and then basically regroup, pick my son up, and, you know, take care of him, feed him, prepare him for the next day, and prepare myself for the next day. So it was a challenge, man. It was a real challenge. I lost a lot of weight really fast. I lost close to 20 pounds in 3 weeks, to the point where, you know, the cadre started to notice that, and they knew there was something going on. You know, and they actually threatened to put me on what's called a meal card, so that I was, you know, I had a card and I was forced to go to the mess hall and eat, mm-hmm. To keep my weight on. But, you know, it was unfortunate what happened, and it sucked balls, to be honest with you. And, I really resented that it even happened to me. You know, if, you know, I just felt like, man, couldn't she have waited till afterwards, you know, or something like that? Not while I'm starting the Q course, right? Because the outcome could have been really bad for me had I not completed the course because of all that, you know. And not only, you know, would it reflect it negatively on me, but from a moral standpoint, you know, for me personally, you know, I think it would have really had an effect on my psyche. So it would have demoralized me quite a bit. So, but anyways, I was determined not to quit. And, you know, I soldiered on. And I got to tell you, man, it was not easy. Thank God I had some really good friends, neighbors that really cared about me. And they were more than happy. The wife was more than happy to take care of my son in the morning for me. So I went through all that. And then, you know, just... you know, a lot of bizarro things started happening, right? So there was a lot of stress. I didn't want the divorce. Then I realized there's another guy involved, you know, and so I was very distracted, trying to maintain focus on school, maintain, you know, my responsibilities to my son, and yet I'm trying to deal with this, you know, this nightmare that I might be getting the divorced and losing, you know. And I was young at the time, by the way. You know, this was in 1989 now, so I think I was about 20, maybe 28, 29, 30, something like that. But I owned two homes already, you know. I was doing pretty good. Mm-hmm. And you know, and I was in fear that, man, I'm gonna lose everything, you know, and include my wife and my kids. So so anyways, as time went on, you know, thank God again, you know, in Special Forces, man, it really is a family. Mm-hmm. You know, it, you know, the guys look out for each other. Any Green Beret is worth his salt, and he's there to really be a Green Beret. He's a brother, man. There's guys there, I'm not gonna lie to you, because I've seen him go through the Q course with me. They're there, they just won the long tab, they won the Green Beret, and they want to say I was a Green Beret, even though they really had no business being there. And I've had them, you know, I've even asked a few guys, what are you doing here? Well, I'm here for the promotions, because I knew they could get promoted fast. Essentially, they were there to get money, get promoted so they get more money. It wasn't about the job, which sucks, right? And, but, you know, those guys are out there, man. And, you know, the only thing you can do with those, man, hopefully is peer them out. And even that was tough to do, peering them out. And I can guarantee you it's probably a lot harder today. Just imagine trying to peer out a woman going through the training, right? It's like, that'll never happen, man. And she could be the most fucked up chick in the whole organization. And that's not going to happen, right? So, and even during my time, it was hard to get rid of a guy and peer them out for, you know, poor performance. And so, you know, I kind of digressed a little bit, but so as I was going through this, my first sergeant recognized and my cadre recognized that, you know, I was having some issues. I was making the standard. Okay, I made PD every day. I didn't fall out on no runs. You can't smoke me, you know. Well, back then you couldn't smoke me on PT. You know, I was there for, you know, for all the class. I was there like I'm supposed to be, right? At least physically for the most part, and mentally to get me through all the training. But I was really struggling, you know, and it was obvious I was not the same guy. The people that knew me knew that, you know, I was out of sorts. So I remember we had to do a practice 12-mile rucksack march every Saturday. I think it was Saturday morning. Very early Saturday morning. Very early Saturday morning. And so it was on Fort Bragg, and it was a place called Tank Trail Road, which was like this dirt road through the woods that was like covered in beach sand. I mean, it was just deep white sand. And so, what we were doing is, again, so that every guy could pass the 12-mile rucksack march for time at the end, what they did is they practiced, you know, we did practice ruck marches, you know, shorter distances, and we just kept extending them, right? Some guys needed that because some guys that were in the Q course came from the Army, you know, they came from support positions in the Army. They were cooks and clerks and mechanics, never carried a rucksack in their life, you know, and 12 miles might as well have been 120 miles for them. For me, it was like a walk in a park. And so, I remember they were practicing, you know, and I went on a few with them, the shorter ones, and then things started getting worse and worse with my personal situation. And I still remember my first sergeant, man, Joe Alfonso. Good, great dude, man, really great, great guy. And he just called me to the side one day and goes, "Look, man," he goes, "I know you can do this 12-mile rucksack march on your hands upside down, walking backwards." And because I've done many more, he knew where I came from. He knew what the standard was there. And so he knew this was not for me going to be a pass or fail type scenario, right? He knew that I would pass no matter what. Now, it wasn't easy. It was 12 miles, 45-pound rucksack. And I think the time was exactly 3 hours. Or 3 hours and 60 minutes or 15 minutes, something like that. But it was roughly around 3 hours. So you're basically doing about 4 miles an hour with a backpack on, right, through the sand. And so he goes, "Look, Comstock," he goes, "I know you got—"
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Got problems going on at home. He goes, "Why don't you just," he goes, "this is a Friday, right?" He goes, "Why don't you just don't worry about doing the rucksack march?" He goes, "You know, I know you can do it. You know, there's no doubt in my mind. I've seen your performance, blah, blah, blah." He goes, "Go home and take care of your personal matters, right? With your ex, well, with your wife, soon to be ex." And I was trying to patch up that marriage. So, you know, I was thankful that, you know, he gave me that opportunity. And so I went home. And I remember when I got home, my wife and I had a blowout, right? So this was not going to go nowhere. There was no way on planet Earth I was going to salvage this thing, no matter what I said or what I did, right? And so we had a big blowout, and now I'm like, what do I do, right? I got nowhere to go. I don't want to be in the house with her. So I went down the road. There was a small, like, kind of like a pizza bar, right? A lot of people go there in the evening. It's a small bar, you know, and a lot of guys like to hang out there and drink and stuff, and kind of a little cool sports bar. And so, and I'm not a heavy drinker. In fact, back then I was really not much of a drinker at all. And so I went to the bar figuring I can go there, just kind of get away, isolate myself, decompress, you know, clear my head, maybe have a couple beers and just, you know, regroup. And so I'm in the bar, and I was in there for quite a while. I'm in a little corner drinking at the table, you know, and I'm knocking them down. I'm getting pretty lit, right? And so after the night wore on, it was probably, I don't know, man, it was probably midnight, 1 o'clock. I look over at the bar, and I look at a guy looking at me, and I'd be goddamn, man, it was First Sergeant Alfonso. he's over there and he sees me drinking, right? And so, and he doesn't have to be out at the road march, right? He's not going to be there anyways, but he sees me over here drinking, and I got about an hour and a half to get out to Tank Trail Road, which was on Fort Bragg, which was about a good 30-minute drive at least, right, to get out there. And so he's kind of looking at me, gives me the nod, you know, and I realize at that point, I go, how does that look? I'm supposed to be home mending my marriage, and yet I'm out here getting drunk, right, in the bar. And so, you know, and he might understand what's going on or he might not, but I didn't feel good about it, you know. So I felt like, damn, you know, how's that going to look, you know. And then I started having these, you know, I have this moral dilemma. It's like, what do you do, you know? Do you stay here? Can't really go home. What do we do, Comstock? And so I decided, you know what? I'm going to do that damn 12-mile rucksack march, even though I'm drunk. And so I got, I had all my gear with me, right? My load bearing equipment, my 45, my rucksack. And I go out to Tank Trail Road, come screeching in and park my car, grab my ruck. And, you know, I wobble into the formation just you know, by the hair on my chinny chin chin. And it's time to go. And I'm telling you, man, it was like if you can just imagine, there's no moonlight. So it's pretty dark. And I'm looking at, you know, the wood line in front of me is just all black except for the trail, the road, which is a dirt road, and it's white desert, it's white beach sand, right? And this is going to go on for hundreds of, might as well be thousands of miles, right? And so, and it's going to be deep. And so I remember we all got on the road and it was go time, man. And I took off and everybody took off, and I thought it was like a dream, like a bad dream, because all I remember was I saw white below me, my feet. I had this dark wall on the left side and the right side, which was the wood line, mm-hmm. right? And I saw a little bit of a light blue hue, or, you know, light. Hey, bro.
Damn.
I don't know.
You're good, man.
I don't know. Yeah, I'm not sure why it's not connecting here.
You're quite all right, my friend.
Yeah, so... All right, so you can still record, right?
Yeah. I'll cut all that shit out, and yeah, like I said, I'll shut up so that we don't have a laggy delay. But yeah, for everybody watching, listening, Dale's having the powers out in Bali, and it's raining here, so that's probably not helping. But yeah, so you were walking along, a strip of white below you, black on either side, blue hue above you.
Yeah, so basically, you know, I was. You know, I was pretty inebriated trying to force my way through this thing, but I was determined to make it through, because ultimately my thinking was, the last thing I want is, you know, tomorrow or somewhere down the road, somebody just say that, you know, I was trying to get over, I didn't have to do the hard parts, you know, and I got a free pass. So, so I decided that I'll go ahead and make the standard like everybody else, except I'll make it harder for myself. I'll do it while I'm drunk. And so I did. And, and I'll be damned, man. I was the last guy to cross the line with like 1 minute to make it, man. With it, despair. But I made it, right? And so I was good. And so that was a win, man. I put that in the win category, you know? And So anyways, so I had some challenges going through the Q course. It was very challenging, obviously, and but I made it, and you know, I got through the course. I got my MOS designator, light and heavy weapons sergeant, and then I went back to the unit. So that brought me up to the last episode we talked about, Modelo Prison. So the training for that, which was only a couple of days. So right after I got back, literally within a day, I started training to assault on Modelo Prison when I got fragged in the leg really bad, and then ended up pulling staff duty, ended up alerting the unit to deploy to Panama. And so that was the last volume, but this happened before before the prison race. So I had my just for few course, got my long cab, became a Green Beret, and then within a few days launched down to Panama. So I post Modelo prison, right, the raid, rescue of Kurt Muse. So what then was, So when everything was over, you know, we redeployed back to Bragg. I was already back in Bragg. Remember I said last time, my unit sent me home so I could take care of my personal affairs, which was actually, it was really cool because as soon as I got back, there was no doubt in my mind it was over. I was ready to let go. And I said goodbye to my ex. And I actually moved into my other home. I had an apartment I was renting out. I moved back into that. And then, she stayed in the other one, so we sold it. And it was over, right? Just like that. And so life went on. About 5 months later, I went down to Panama. We went back to Panama. Actually, got into survival training in the jungle, and which is interesting, right? So everything was normalized again, back to business. And we went down to the Darien province. So the idea was to go out to the Darien jungle, which is still one of the most remote jungles in the world, and go out there and spend, you know, like 5 days, 6 days out doing jungle survival training. So the idea was to land in helicopters. Each team gets deposited somewhere in the jungle. We go off and stay out there with just our car 15s and our load bearing equipment and all the survival equipment that we had on normally carry SOP in our butt packs, right? We didn't bring any food with us. We didn't bring any shelters with us. It was just what we were wearing. And so try to make it as realistic, as realistic as we could. So we went out there and we did that. And it was kind of an interesting experience because the area we got dropped off on in was a cleared area in the jungle that was big enough to support two blacks landing at one time. And it was the only area that was clear to land anything within a 50-mile radius, right? That's how dense and remote this jungle was. Those grew up really fast in the jungle, right? In fact, there used to be an old railroad that ran through the jungle because they used it to transport gold from one of the gold mines down south to north. Completely overgrown, you know. You could tell, you know, it's been there for a while. So that was the only thing that we kind of saw that, resembled any kind of civilization at some point. What was really cool was also coming across some of the Indians. I mean, real Indians, you know. I mean, still very primitive, you know. New boobs hanging out, you know, bows and arrows, you know. And, some National Geographic stuff going on there, too. So anyways, we're out in the jungle. My team gets dropped off. We stay out there and we find a little area that we're gonna call our home. And we start setting up, our little base camp. And then I go out with one of my guys, and our job is to go find something to eat. And it's like we're in the jungle, so you'd think there would be like animals and creatures all over the place, right? Like plenty of things to eat. But it's like the weirdest thing, like nothing to eat, not even fruit, right? Like what the hell, man? We walked and walked and walked for miles down this one like little trail. And finally, man, after some period of time, it was a long day, I hear a squawking noise over the tree, and I look up and there's a bird up there, right? And so it's a blackbird. So I'm thinking, okay, maybe it's a buzzard or something, but it's food, right? So I shoot him with my car 15. He comes falling out of his tree, and it's an eagle, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's titled Eagles Are Chickens, right? Eagles are chickens with an R. And so I'm like, well, this eagle's a chicken now, man. But I felt kind of bad about it, right? Yeah. So believe it or not, after I shot it, I thought, man, that's an eagle, right? And so as assaulters, as Delta operators, we call ourselves eagles, right? We had pro words that we used to describe, operators from hostages, from terrorists, right? So when we communicated over the radio, it makes sense. So I'm looking at this bird thinking that's an eagle, and for some reason, my superstitious mindset started taking over. I thought, man, I'm going to pay for that. The karma's going to get me, And so I wrapped him up in a MRE bag and stuffed him in my cargo pocket. And we come home, and we're getting ready to cross this river, me and my teammate. It's a relatively wide river. I say wide, maybe 30 feet across, but it's fast flowing. It's relatively deep, certain spots. And I had a lot of rocks and boulders. And as I'm getting ready to cross, I see in a pool of water, I see what I swear to God, I thought it was a dolphin, right? Like, what the hell is that? It's like big, right? It's under the water and it's cruising along, and all of a sudden it pops out and he's got these big brown eyes like a seal. And of course, it was what they call a river otter, right? And yeah, they're pretty damn big. And it was, you know, and it was the jungle.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
And so this thing pops out and just, for whatever reason, I decided I'm going to shoot this son of a bitch. Man, there's Chow right there, right? And he takes off, and I just start opening up on him. I swear to God, I missed him. I couldn't hit him. He was so fast, right, in the water, jumping out on all the rocks and stuff. Like, holy shit. So the rest of the team, heard all the gunfire, right? And they're thinking, oh shit, you know, something bad is happening out there. So they're getting kitted up and getting ready to go fight. And we come walking back with a, you know, an MRE bag with a chicken in it, right? A black chicken. And I go, you know, we told them the story and stuff. And then, what are you going to do, Comstock? I said, well, we're going to eat this thing, man. And so, you know, I'm thinking, okay, how are we going to cook it, right? Yeah. So I'm going to pluck all the feathers off and I'm going to wrap it up. And then I'm gonna build a fire underground, you know, survival type, you know, they call it clandestine fire, and put a heated charcoal down the bottom, and then I'm gonna lay this thing in there, and I'm gonna cover up with dirt, and then it's gonna bake, and then tomorrow morning we'll cut chicken for breakfast, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, then we went to sleep, and you know, sleep in the jungle is kind of interesting, man. If anybody's ever been out there in a jungle, a real jungle, it's always wet, it's damp, and so things are breaking all night long and falling out of the tree. So it sounds like things are creeping up on you, around you all the time. You know, you hear animals, you hear howler monkeys. Now, those are really freaky, man, because they sound like, they actually sound like a lion roaring, man. And they're little, man, they're little monkeys, but when they howl, it's not even a howl, a roar. It sounds like a damn lion, man. And especially when a whole group of them are moving, a troop, right? And they start doing that. It's pretty freaky, right? And they do it up in the trees. They're high up in the trees, and they move pretty good. And so you hear that, and then there are jaguars out there. I saw a few. So, you know, when you start seeing this thing and putting it all together, you know, it kind of gets you on edge a little bit, you know. But at least I had my team with me, and we were loaded for bears, so it wasn't really that big of a deal. But I've actually been in the jungle by myself like that down in Guatemala for a few days. And then it gets a little interesting when you're by yourself, right? Mm-hmm. It's harder to sleep because you can't pull, you know, there's only one guy to pull security, and you're it all night. So I remember we were out there a couple of days now, you know, the chicken, the eagle, right? When I pulled them up, it's just like, well, it was not looking very good. Like, it wasn't looking very edible at all. I'm not eating that shit. It's like, what happened to it, man? It's like, it's been buried, and it looks like it's been buried alive, you know? And so then we get a call of the radio and said, basically what the call said was this: assemble out on the HLZ, helicopter landing zone, and be prepared to get picked up. Apply about 5 miles south. There's a gold mine right on the border of Colombia, and it was believed, intel sources said, there were still remnants of the Panamanian Defense Forces and the Dignitary Battalion, the militia, holed up there still from, you know, the initial invasion 5 months earlier. And so basically, the mission is drop our ruts, leave behind, get on the birds, fly, land, get off, and whatever happens, happens, right? And so that was the mission, right? Whatever happens, happens, you know, and get it done. And so
that's the mission. Whatever happens, happens. Like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, you know, and so we go out to HLZ, and, you know, the Blackhawks are about an hour flight from Panama City Beach. And, you know, we put our rucksacks down. We actually took some pictures. I got the pictures of my team still, you know, on the HLZ, taking photos of the team. And then the birds show up, and we load the birds. So it's two by two. So we had two helicopters land, and actually helicopters had to take a guy back to Gordon's Army Hospital because he got fragged by Claymore, his own Claymore, right, during some training stuff they were doing. So we lost one bird, and now we're down to three. So the first two landed, my team got on the first bird, and that bird is the one that had the auxiliary tank on it with the extra fuel. It had a total of 15 people on it, including the crew of four. And, you know, and basically no seats, you know, which is pretty SOP at the time. You know, you sit on the floor, and off we left, right? So we leave the jungle floor. We start flying. We get up to about 260 feet altitude. And all of a sudden I hear the number one engine on the left side make this loud vacuum sound, like woof, right? Mm-hmm. And as soon as it did that, you could feel the helicopter losing lift. And it's, you know, pretty much when you fly in a helicopter enough, you know, it's going to get bumpy at times. There's going to be turbulence. It's going to do weird things, you know. And so they can freak you out if you don't know what's going on. So what you always tend to do, I do, is look at the crew chiefs. If they're not freaking out, I'm not freaking out, right? So, and so when this happened, the first thing I did is look at the crew chiefs. And they're freaking out.
Oh,
holy hell, they're freaking out. And not only are they freaking out, but none of the alarms and sirens and bells and whistles were going off in the cockpit at the same time, which was really freaking me out, right? And you could feel the helicopter lose and lift. It's like being in an elevator. Mm-hmm. You could feel it like going down.
Yeah, yeah.
Your guts up in your mouth, you know? And so this is when time slowed down, right? So I believe I talked about autogenic conditioning before, and how I rehearsed for this before this event, right? And I mentally rehearsed for it years earlier. Not this particular event, but an event like this. What do you do if a helicopter crashes and you're in it, right? So as I said before, there's really not a lot you can do because you're up in the air in a piece of aluminum magnesium and it's falling out of the sky and you're inside of it, right? Mm-hmm. So you're at the mercy of gravity and luck, so to speak. So but I did actually have a plan for that I had thought about in my mind one time, mentally rehearsed it, stored it in my subconscious, and it started happening, right? So when the helicopter crashed, you know, you have the fight or flight center sets in, right? So this was a case where, you know, I ain't really nowhere. There's nowhere to flight to, right? Mm-hmm. We're in the flight. So, so the fear factor is definitely there, right? Because you know this thing is going to crash and it's going to hurt bad. Mm-hmm. You know, history has told me before from all the other crashes that, you know, we sustained in the organization that I know about the military, Black Hawk crashes are not good, man. Mm-hmm. They're bad. They're really bad. So I remember as this thing's going down, if you can just imagine time slowing down, right? I see tree limbs coming through the windshield, you know, all kinds of craziness is going up. The rotor blades strike the top of the trees and they snap off, literally snap off to the hub. There's no rotor blades left. The pilots kill the fuel. Mm-hmm. You know, that was their SOP, kill the fuel right off the bat, right? Hit the lever for that. This was all at 206 feet when this happened. 206 feet was what was registered on Black Box. And I remember going through, just without even thinking about it, I went through my mental rehearsal, my mental plan that I rehearsed one time. I did it. And it's a form of autogenic conditioning. It's what I teach in my performance coaching courses that I teach to people. And so what I ended up doing was going through the procedures, which was get rid of the headgear, which was a booty cap at the time. Get rid of the weapon, which was a CAR 15 with an MO203 grenade launcher, you know, aim point attached to it, QXL white lights. You know, get rid of this thing. I don't need it. It's going to get in my way when I crash, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to get out. I dumped it. I got my load bearing equipment off. And then I reached up and I grabbed some red cargo rings. A red cargo ring was on the roof, right? Which is normally in the Blackhawks. So I got a handle on those. I took a knee and. And then the next thing that happened, the helicopter turned sideways. Now, we had no doors. All I can remember is like hanging out the door sideways, looking down at the ground, hanging on these red cargo rings, going, oh, shit. And then it went belly down again. And then the next thing I remember was, when is this thing going to make contact? When are we going to hit? It just seemed like forever, right? Mm-hmm. And so But it wasn't. It was like super fast, but it slowed down. And I'm thinking, when's it going to hit? When's it going? I'm you know, anticipating the impact. And when it happened, it was totally unexpected, right? It happened so fast and so violently that when we hit, like, it just ripped me loose from the cargo wing, slammed me on my back up into the cockpit. And then all of a sudden, it was real quiet. And I don't know if I was unconscious. I don't know if I was in shock. I don't know if I was just stunned. I don't know what happened, but it seemed like there was a space there from falling to all of a sudden, like, going, hey, where the hell am I, right? Mm-hmm. And so I remember I heard a hissing sound coming from the top of the helicopter, which was actually the engines, and they were on fire. Mm-hmm. And there was nobody in the helicopter, as I could tell, with me, right? Everything was empty. And the crew chiefs literally got squirted out of their seats, out over the machine guns, out into the forest, which is really bizarre. It's like, man, how's that happen? They get squirted out over through the windows over the machine gun. Guys in the back all got launched out the back, right? And so I'm laying on my back thinking, holy hell, I'm the only person left in the helicopter, not realizing the two pilots are still in the front seat, not realizing that one of our guys, our combo guy, was behind me. He was sitting on a 20-millimeter ammo can, and he crushed the damn thing like a beer can. He sat, I mean, he was covered in blood, but he crushed his pelvis. He about died out there. I mean, they had to resuscitate him quite a few times. He had a lot of internal pain, but I didn't know what was behind me smashed up into the cockpit as well, because I'm facing down like the rear of the helicopter. And so in my mind, I'm thinking, holy shit, I'm the only guy in here. And then I thought, well, maybe they already left. Forgot about me. I don't know what was going on. I was like totally dazed, right? Like I was drunk again, right? Yeah. So then it occurred to me that I got to get out of this helicopter. And it was about the same time I realized that my back was broken. And no doubt in my mind, my back was broken, right? It felt like King Kong had grabbed me by my chest and my waist and just kind of wrung this to me, right? It was wringing me out and broke my back. I mean, it's also just excruciating pain. And
with Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
But I couldn't let that slow me down, so I rolled over my belly, I crawled to the edge of the helicopter, and the helicopter was sitting on top of another fallen tree that had knocked over, right? So it was probably from the bottom of from the helicopter floor to the ground was probably about a 3 or 4 foot fall, right? And so, but I had to get out. And so I didn't want to stay inside the helicopter and get burned up or anything like that, right? So I climb out. I crawl a few feet as far as I can go, which is not far. I roll over onto this another tree that's laying there and put my head on it. And then I started looking around. That's when I realized everybody was unconscious that was inside the helicopter. They were scattered all over the jungle floor, right? Mm-hmm. And my teammate, one of my guys on my team, was laying next to me a couple feet on his back. And he had a broken leg, he had blood coming out of his mouth, but he's still conscious. And he had the presence of mind to pull out a PRC 122 radio out of his backpack, and he put it on the emergency beacon mode. So the emergency beacon mode alerts other aircraft in the area that there's an emergency, and it kind of gives a location for it, right? Mm-hmm. So he pulled it out, he hit that, you know, and it was making a wee, 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 wee sound, right? And I looked over to him, and I was so pained. I thought, Jesus, man, this guy, he's a medic. He can help me. I'm Tom, I need help on my back. And he's broke. And I remember this was like a scene out of Forrest Gump, you know. He looks over at me, he goes, Bubba, ain't nothing I can do for you. My leg's broke. I was like, shit. and so I landed and I looked to my right. And this is when I saw the door gunners, right? One of the crew chiefs, he ended on his back. And he's unconscious, and his lips got ripped off, right? And was kind of like flapped over his face, and he's not moving, right? I thought he was dead, man. Mm-hmm. I mean, he just looked mess, right? He just landed in there's only one guy that actually was ambulatory, survived the crash, and was actually on his feet moving. And at the time, I think he was the only black guy in the unit. Mm-hmm. His name was Charles. He was in my troop. He used to be a helicopter crew chief, mm-hmm. so he's very familiar with helicopters. And he had the presence of mind to climb up on top of the helicopter with a fire extinguisher and put the fire out, which is probably a good thing because this thing had an auxiliary tank in the back full of fuel. And if this thing would have continued to burn, who knows, man? We might have blown up and, you know, doused us all with fuel because we're all laying right around the helicopter, you know? Yeah. And so he managed to put the fire out, and he got rewarded for that. I don't think he got duly rewarded. If I remember right, the award that he got was not, I didn't feel like it was worthy of his heroics, you know, so to speak. But you know, it wasn't because he was black. It was just because Army had this stupid quota. Said, right, you can only have so many medals go out, you know, this mm-hmm. many of this kind. This many, it's just some weird bullshit, right? Mm-hmm. So anyways, but you know, he put the fire out, man, and he gets the credit for all that. So a little while later, you know, the other helicopters watched this crash. They flew back to the HLZ, and they land, and the guys get out with all their machetes and stuff, start going into the jungle to find us. And they do finally catch up. They find out where we're located. And I remember one of the guys was saying that as they got closer, they didn't know where we were because it was really quiet. That's mm-hmm. what I do remember. It was super quiet, like eerie, man, quiet. Everybody was asleep, you know, except for Tom and the damn radio. Yeah. But it was pretty damn quiet. And so one of the guys said, as he was cutting through the jungle, and he saw and felt hydraulic fluid on some of the leaves. It looked like red cherry juice, mm-hmm. you know? And when he saw that, he really freaked him out. Like, holy shit, is that blood or is that hydraulic fluid, yeah. you know? And but he knew he was close to us, and they show up. And did I tell the story already?
No.
Okay. It's all running together, man. I think I just told the story the other day. No. So anyways, what ended up happening was, we're laying there, spread it out. They come over and start to triage us. I say they, the rest of the troop. And, you know, they're working feverishly to get us sorted out, you know, help everybody. There's some, you know, we got one guy that's dying. Resuscitate him. We're in bad shape. So I'm laying, I got a couple guys, you know, working on me. And they shoot me up with morphine right away. And then I still remember... The guy was one of the guys. His name was Sam. He was trying to help me out. He had a canteen with, you know, what we thought I thought was water. I guess he thought maybe it was water, but he actually had orange Gatorade in it, right? And so he poured it on my face, thinking it would cool me down. I'm like, it tastes like orange Gatorade, right? And so, but you know, whatever. And but I still remember him doing that, right? And then. So they were, you know, they're all running around hustling, trying to help everybody, you know, stabilize everybody. And then, you know, they brought the only spine boards we had was a couple, I think. And they're loading guys on spine boards and cheering them out. Well, after a while, I'm laying there gooned out on morphine. And I noticed it's been quieter and quieter and quieter. And then I started looking around and going, where the hell is everybody at? It all left and forgot me, literally forgot me laying out in the jungle, right on morphine. And I could see the last guy about, I don't know, 30, 40 meters away going into the jungle. And it occurred to me, there's nobody else here but me. And they forgot about me. And so I yelled out, hey! And I could hear guys go, oh shit, hey. We've got cops on. Come on. And they come running back, you know. And hey, sorry, dude, man. We got you. And I'm like, what the fuck, man? That's like the second time you guys were behind. The last time with the Modelo prison.
Jesus Christ. And I was going to say, and you always end up in the jungle inebriated, drunk or on morphine.
Right, exactly. So, so anyway, they put me on a spine board. They carried me out, put me on a helicopter, medevac us all back to Gorgas Army Hospital, which is about an hour flight. It was actually in May on Mother's Day, and the time of the crash was exactly 3:30 p.m. right in mm-hmm. Panama. And so when we got there, you know, they had a limited staff in the hospital because it was Mother's Day, it was a holiday, nobody working Sunday, right? Everybody's gone. And so, you know, they got a mass casualty event, and they're trying to deal with you know, and you know, they had me on a gurney in a hallway. They already cut all my clothes off, and they had me covered up in a white sheet. So I'm laying there, you know, and there's not too many people in the hospital. And so I'm laying there. I could feel this like itching, nagging, biting feeling right down my groin and my balls. I'll be specific about it, right? So can't see it because I can't move because my back's broke and I'm morphine, right? And I'm kind of laying there, kind of paralyzed, so to speak. So one of my best friends, was there. He and I would ride to work every morning. He would pick me up and take me to work because it was time. And I won't mention his last name, just to, again, I promised him I wouldn't tell anybody this, so I'll just use his name, Tommy. And he's a really good guy. He's an older guy. He was always laughing, man. You could never make him mad, Even when he was mad, he was always laughing and smiling. He was just a good-hearted dude, man. Just a really good guy, man. And he's been through some shit too, man. He's been through some life and death experiences, some serious ones, man. And he was lucky to be alive himself. So he's there with me, and I go, "Hey, Tommy," I said, "dude," I said, "something is mauling me down there in my junk, right?" And he's like, "What?" I go, "Yeah, dude." I said, "Something's down there, but I know it is." I come on, my what? I go, "No, I don't know." I said, "Something's bothering me, right?" And I said, "Really, I can feel it, dude. It ain't right." And so he's like, I said, "Take a look and tell me what you think." And he laughs and goes, "Dude, come on." He's looking up at the doll. "Oh, man, I can't do that. Come on, man. Come on, Tommy." And then I said, "It's good." And you can tell I get a little desperate, right? And he's like, okay. He goes, "Hold on." And he lifts the sheet up. And he's looking at my junk. And then he puts the sheet down. His eyes are all big. He looks at me. He goes, "Dude." He goes, "You're covered in ticks." Right? I don't know why I was covered in ticks, but I guess when I was laying on the jungle floor, all the ticks saw me laying there and go, "Hey, let's go get this guy. Let's go follow his balls because he can't freaking do nothing about it," right? Because normally they go to your armpits, they go to your legs and shit.
Medically, your scrotum is actually hotter than the rest of your body. That's just a product of evolution. And if they're sucking blood, their instincts are going to go, like you said, armpits, they're going to heat centers. So that makes sense.
Oh, there you go. That makes a lot of sense now, right? When she said that. Well, anyways, they all convened down there, man, and they were having a party.
Jesus Christ.
And it was bad, right? And I've been bitten by ticks a lot, right? But never had I had that many, apparently, at one time, concentrated in one area that's like super sensitive, right? And so he's like, "Dude, you got it." He goes, "You're covering ticks, right?" And I'm, "Tommy, you got to get him off, brother. You got to get him off. I'm getting desperate now. You got to get him off, man." And he's like, "Dude, I can't do that, man." He's like, "No way, man." And he's freaking out. I'm freaking out. And he's kind of giggling. I'm like kind of crying. "Come on, man." and he's like, "Dude," and nobody's in the hallway, right? I said, "Come on, man. You got to help me." Right? Mm-hmm. He goes, "All right." He goes, "You can't tell nobody about this ever." I said, "Shh. No way. I'll never tell nobody."
And now here you are.
I get to work, right? Come on, man. He's like, "Man." And so he pulls a sheet over his head, which is funnier than shit, right? He's got the sheet over his head. He's under there. And he's working on me, right? And he gets them all off. And he pops out. He's like, "Dude, got them all. I freaking bunch of them." And I was like, "Oh, man, brother." I said, "Man, you're the man. I love you, man." I said, "I'll never tell anybody."
And now here you are on my podcast, telling the story.
Well, I didn't tell his last name, but sure. So I saved his last name. But anyways, for him to do that, man, was, I was just like, "Wow, man, you really are a friend, I ended up in the ER room. Basically, there were five of us that had severely broken backs. Mine was an L2, L3 compression fracture. I was like just, a micromillimeter from, being paralyzed. And they loaded us up on another C-130. It was to Santa Maria to the hospital there. And I spent about a week in the hospital, flat on my back, not even in a cast yet, just on my back. And it was I hadn't done anything, right? So for like 7 days, I'm laying there under a sheet, naked. I hadn't had a shower. I'm covered in camouflage and, you know, and dirt and shit and grimy. But the cool thing was I had like three nurses every day that would come in and clean me up, you know, wash my ass, teach me, you know what? So, and then they decided to medevac us all to Womack Army Hospital, Fort Bragg, and then cast us there. So they stabilized us and then got us to Fort Bragg, and that's where we had our cast, our body cast put on. So we sustained a lot of injuries. We had two guys, including one of my assistant team leader, was paralyzed permanently from the waist down, and one of the crew chiefs. You know, a lot of broken bones, a lot of bruises and contusions, but actually no fatalities. And the surgeon actually chalked that up to the physical condition that we were in, because we were all in pretty good shape. Mm-hmm. And they said, you know, it would have been far worse had we not been physically fit.
Yeah.
You know, again, to those guys who are listening out there, you know, word of the wise man, you know, don't forgo your health and your fitness, man. That's got to be a part of your lifestyle every day.
Yeah.
And it will increase your longevity, not just in an accident, but just in life.
Yeah.
You know, I'm 58 years old now, man, and I feel as good as I ever did. With all the injuries I've had, nothing is slowing me down. Nothing mm-hmm. hurts. I don't wake up in the morning with creaky arms and legs and necks and backs. I just spring out of the bed, and, you know, I'm as spry as I ever was at 58, you know. And so, you know, and I've always been an athlete, man, since I can remember, since I was a little kid, you know, of course, with the military and what I had to do there. Physical fitness has always been a part of my daily routine. It's an absolute, man. It's got to be a part of the day. It's imperative. It's not optional. Well, if I have time, I'll do it. No. You're gonna make time, man, doing it, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's key, because too many people have the wrong mindset about that. You know, it's like, well, if I have time, I'll do it, but I never have enough time. Bullshit, man. If I got time, I'm the busiest man in the world. You got time.
Yeah.
You can make time, man.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like right now, it's 12:07 midnight. Okay, I'm making time to do a podcast, and I'm making time to tell you out there to get fit, right? So, and oh, by the way, I actually did another podcast this morning, 2 hours, and I've been working all day. And it's Sunday here, and I actually took my wife out, and I'm teaching her how to ride my motorcycle. I got a pretty cool little cruiser, right, Benelli, and so I got her riding on that. We did that for a while, and then we got on a bike, took a long ride, and you know, tooling around, and then went back to the office. So, you know, I put in some long hours, but you know, I find time for physical fitness. You have to. So, anyways, that was the experience that I had in the jungle post Modelo prison. Panama invasion was Mother's Day, and you know, and so let me expand on that just a little bit. So some things that kind of happened from that were kind of interesting was this. So after I got the body cast on, our surgeon at the time, he wasn't even a surgeon, he was a osteopath, and the unit had several medical doctors assigned to it, right? So this guy was like one of the top doctors in the military. He was an osteopath, specialized, you know, in bones and stuff like that. And he put us all in pink body casts as a joke. And I didn't find it funny. I'm like, come on, dude, give me a black one or something.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
No, and you know, black one with some white racing stripes or something like, but not, you know, come on, pink. I'm the doctor, you're going in pink. He was dead serious, man. He put us on. And then what they have to do, if you have a body cast, they have to cut out a circle around the belly for expansion, right? So when you're eating, you know, you got room, right? Otherwise, it's like everything's compressed inside this body cast, and that ain't gonna be good. So what does he do? He doesn't give us a circle. He cuts his heart. So I got a heart shape cut into my pink body cast,
so
right?
And it's Care summertime.
Bears. Oh, yeah, man. We, you know, definitely, man. We're a bunch of Fruit Loops, man. And so it's summertime, and you can't wear a shirt over this stuff because the body cast is really thick and it's lined with you know, cotton and cotton material. So, and it's got also the cotton, like a buffer in it, right? So it's thick. It's like wearing body armor all day long, right? And it doesn't flex, though. That's the other thing. And mine was all the way up to my neck and went all the way down to my groin, just on top of my, you know, my cock, right? And so I'm like a turtle, man. And so I can't bend over. I can't do anything. It's like, you know, it's like I can't do anything in this stupid thing. And which made it very challenging. Luckily, I had a waterbed. That actually helped, sleeping in a waterbed, because I didn't feel like I had a lot of pressure from the cast under my body. Sure. So that was a good thing. But the problem was, a real challenge was taking a shower. And now that I was separated from my ex-wife, I had a new girlfriend. And she came and gave me basically a bath every day, right? So I'd stand up in the shower like a little kid, and she'd give me a sponge bath, you know, because that's all I could do, right? And, yeah, it was not, you know, it was definitely not not fun. But that part was, but even that wasn't fun because I couldn't do nothing with it. Anyways, but within a week, I think, after that, I was back at the unit training, literally on the range, put my ammo, my gun belt on, and my shorts, my assault boots, and I would go out training, man. I would shoot, you know. I did everything I could possibly do in a body cast, you know, like I did before. So, and that was not just me, it was everybody, right? Get guys out there with casts on their legs or out there shooting and training. So we didn't ride the profile, right? Mm-hmm. So the profile is basically taking medical time off, right? Because the doctors go, hey, we're going to give you, you know, 3 weeks profile. You know, that means you don't do shit, right? Mm-hmm. You get to do whatever, right? Screw off. None of us took that, man. I mean, it was given to us, but we all came to work, you know, lame and broken and in pain, but we still were there training, right? So that's, again, that speaks a lot about Delta operators and our mindset, you know. You know, it doesn't matter if we're broken or we're hurt or we're wounded. You know, we're going to come back and train as soon as we can stand on our feet. Mm-hmm. And if we can't stand on our feet, we'll train on our backs. But we're going to train and keep working, right?
Yeah.
So so what happened was, also, I went home to California. I had convalescent. So I just had to fly home and go see my mom and dad in the time I lived in Sacramento, California. And so, well, I got to talk, and, you know, I talked to my mom and dad about the event. You know, they already knew about it. And what I didn't know was, on the day that my helicopter crashed, at the exact same time in California, where I counted for the time change, but it was mm-hmm. the exact same time that I crashed, my mom, who's in perfect health, even to this day, she's 74 and in perfect health. Perfect, man. She's never sick, never been to the hospital for nothing. Nothing's wrong with this woman. Very robust, hardcore German woman. Mm-hmm. And she's at work one day. In fact, she worked for Montgomery Ward's in the furniture department. And she's worked there for years and years and years. And, you know, walking the halls and stuff like that, you know, the aisles. And one day she's walking the aisles when this happened. And she just got lightheaded and passed out and fell out on the floor. So they called the ambulance, they picked her up, they took her to the hospital, they checked her out, and they looked at her and go, ma'am, there is absolutely nothing wrong with you. Your blood pressure is normal. Everything is within, you know, limits, man, within, you know, parameters. And we don't know why you passed out. She said, I don't know why I passed out either. You're fine. There's nothing wrong with you. She's like, okay. And she went home, and she's been fine ever since that day. But what happened was, you know, when it happened exactly at the same time I crashed, here's what I think happened. I think my mom, she somehow, because we're connected, right? Mm-hmm. And this goes into the metaphysical stuff that we've talked about before, right? Yeah. And frequency. I believe my mom was able to sense, pick up the frequency of my fear, because I got to tell you, I was like, oh shit, I'm gonna die.
Yeah.
That's why I was doing all the stuff that I was doing, right? It's like, this is it, this is gonna be bad. She probably picked that up and sensed that, and she probably was overwhelmed with my fear that she passed out.
Yeah.
Okay. And you know how I know that that's probably true? Because years later, my father, he had two heart attacks. The first one was bad. He didn't take it serious. He was smoking a lot. Said, oh yeah, I'm gonna quit. He never quit. He's always had back sneaking around smoking. And about 3 years later, caught up with him again. This time it almost killed him. And it was a wake-up call for him. Oh, here's what happened on the second one. I was in Lisbon, Portugal. My whole special forces team was over there for 2 months. We were doing what's called live environment training. And basically, they used to call it language immersion training, but it wasn't immersion. It's called live environment training, where we were there living with each guy was living with a Portuguese family for 2 months, learning how to speak the language, assimilate the culture. And the reason we were there learning Portuguese is because my special forces team our area of responsibility was Angola, right? Mm-hmm. Which is a, we used to be a Portuguese colony, et cetera, et cetera. And also one of our other AOs was Iraq. So, but because Angola was our area of operations, we needed to know how to speak Portuguese, right? So we went through, we actually went through the formal training in the military for 6 months, and then we went to Portugal for the live environment training. So we were all split up. We had different, actually, I didn't even have a family. What happened was, I was staying in this three-bedroom apartment by myself. The family was living somewhere else, mm-hmm. but they used their address, and basically, the mom would show up every morning and cook me breakfast, and then, you want anything else? I'm like, nope, I'm going to go to school. Okay, see you tomorrow morning. That was it. Like, there was no immersion training with her, right? They kind of was like getting money, and you know, I wasn't actually living with her, which I was cool with it. I was like, you know, I don't really want them around anyways, you know, it's kind of awkward. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm getting enough training outside. So I had this apartment for myself for 2 months. So the only time my team and I would get together was after language school, and during the day, we'd all go to the gym and work out at the gym, and then we'd split, you know, we'd break and go off back to our homes, and then the next day do it again. On Sunday, we met. No, on one particular Sunday we met. We're going to meet at a certain time, like 5 p.m., something like that, in the evening, downtown Lisbon. So I'm walking around town, and, you know, I'm shopping and, you know, just taking things in. And the entire day, man, I had this nagging sensation about me. Something didn't feel right. And I kept thinking about my dad. Mm-hmm. I kept at the time my dad had a heart attack, and I just kept reliving it, thinking it over and over. Things were just gnawing at me, you know, and I'm thinking, Comstock, man, come on, focus, dude. You know, what are you, you know? And so later on that evening, I met my team at an outdoor cafe. We were all sitting around. The only guy that wasn't there yet was the captain, team leader. And a little while later, he shows up. He's like, Comstock. He goes, hey, did you talk to your wife yet? I go, no. He goes, you need to call your wife right now. Like, oh shit, right? So I run, and I didn't have cell phones back then. So I go find a payphone. I make a long distance call home. I had my AT&T calling card, mm-hmm. and I call my wife at the time. And as soon as she answers, you know, I tell her, hey, what's going on? She's like, okay, don't panic. Okay, just relax. Okay, it's okay. I'm like, what? Yeah. She goes, your dad had another heart attack, but he's okay. He's alive, right? He's gonna be okay. I said, how the fuck did I know that, man? Yeah. Right? I'm freaking out, right? I said, how did I know that, man? You know, I'm like spinning around going, what? You know, and so he was okay. He actually stopped smoking, and he lived a healthy life for a long time after that. You know, he passed away a few years ago. But again, that was another example of where I experienced my father's anguish, pain, fear, whatever he was going through. I was sensing that somehow. Mm-hmm. And I got 1,000 stories like that. So anyway, that's kind of like my story about the post Modelo prison rescue mission to our survival training in the jungle, and how that all came about. And then, and then this experience that I had with my mother. So I think we're like an hour and 20 minutes into this thing already. Time flies, man. next time around, man, I'm looking at my book right now at the chapters. So I stay focused here. But next time I'll be talking about my experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan. So again, you know, the next story will be about Sadr City and, in my adventures there, which were pretty interesting, and then we're just going to keep building onto that. So we got a ways to go still. Fuck, I think, yeah. We're about a third of the way through the book right now.
No rush, man. So. No rush, dude. I fucking enjoy these. I was gonna say real quick. Yeah, pat on that author several times, Dr. Evan Alexander, who's literally a Harvard neurosurgeon, and he fell into a coma in 2010. And survived, like a 1 in 50 million chance. He wrote a book called Proof of Heaven, but he talks about in a second book, Living in a Mindful Universe. But he talks about that, people connecting when on different sides of the world. But yeah, mothers, yeah. Fathers, children, siblings, grandparents, best friends, spouses, yeah. These things happen on like different sides of the planet at the exact same time, no communication. And it's when someone is in just like, it's when someone dies. Or it's when someone is in like mortal peril, and it's
it's very true. I've experienced it more than once, more than twice. actually many times at different levels. But, you know, so I'll just kind of, you know, kind of round it out with this. You know, everything in this planet, everything is frequency. Everything has energy at the molecular level, man. Mm-hmm. I don't care what it is, right? So the fact that I'm talking to you right now through a phone, my phone, halfway around the world, through my wife's Wi-Fi on her phone, the reason all that is possible is because, one, I'm using energy that my body creates from within, right? I'm not plugged into a wall. I don't have battery pack on me. Mm-hmm. I have to produce my own energy to think. So as I'm thinking, I take those thoughts, I put them into words. Actually, what I'm doing is I'm creating frequency like a radio, mm-hmm. okay? I'm creating wavelength and frequency, okay? And it's coming through my voice box, you know, with my mouth, my tongue, and everything. And so I'm actually vibrating frequency of molecules in the air, which we call frequency, right? Mm-hmm. Different frequencies and different wavelengths of these molecules moving. You're listening, you're hearing these frequencies and wavelengths, and you're assigning a meaning to every part of that frequency, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's called communication, right? That's called language. And so, if I was speaking to you in Swahili, right? If I could speak in Swahili, you'd be like, what? You wouldn't understand a word I'm saying. But the moment you can start assigning a thought or a definition to any tone or any part, any inflection in my voice, then we're now communicating, right? Mm-hmm. Now you start to understand what I'm saying. And the more you do that, the more assignments you make, it's called language, right? But it's all based on, they call the law of vibration, right? Vibratory principles, but that's nothing more than frequency. That's all that is, the energy. So the whole world and everything within the world is energy. I can go on all day on this topic, but so everything in the world is interconnected. If everything is moving at the molecular level, then basically it's like pool balls, right? Everything's mm-hmm. connected, interconnected, and everything has an effect on everything else. Primarily when we're talking, when we're thinking, we're talking, even when we're not talking, but we're thinking, we're expressing energy, just like a radio transmitter, right? Mm-hmm. We're sending out signals, and it's either positive or it's negative, but it's some type of information. It's going to go out and it's going to come back, okay? And if, like I said, my dad was experiencing something, probably fear, pain, you know, all kinds of anguish. And he's put that frequency out there. And because biologically his son, I'm already tuned into my dad and his frequency. So it's easier for me to receive that. But actually everybody receives it, but most people filter that. Mm-hmm. Don't even know that filter. It's subconscious, right? You filter it out and you don't pay attention to it. It's not until it's something meaningful to you that you start getting that, the hair starts standing up on the back of your neck. And so... yeah, it's for sure, man. I mean, even look, Nikola Tesla, you know, he said the same thing. If you want to understand the universe,
think in terms of energy and frequency. Yeah,
it's a term, exactly, right? If you know, Albert Einstein has said that. There's so many physicists out there that say the same thing, that the real understanding of the universe is understanding, you know, frequency and how that works, and energy. If you can understand that and how to manipulate it, you can create your reality, whatever you want it to be, whether it's whatever success it is or whatever failure it is. You already know that because we talked about this before, your experience from we first talked about it to where you are today, my experiences with it. It's an interesting phenomenon, man. And I just wish to God I had learned this when I was like a teenager, man, and I could apply it to in my life, you know. Yeah. I applied it unwittingly. And it wasn't until my adult life I figured out what it was. I realized this was a thing and actually had names to it. And then I realized this is just science. And it's like, why don't they teach this in school? And, and it's because most people, it's too much to get their head around, right? Mm-hmm. They want it simple. Mm-hmm. Rather than be deep thinkers, it's like just give me the Reader's Digest version. Yeah, okay, got it, right? Those that really delve into this and think about this and think about the meaning of life are the ones that are going to go far, are going to be successful, are going to be happier. I can speak for myself on that one. That's my whole life has changed in the last 15 years easily, because now I have a really deep understanding of all this stuff, and I understand how we're all interrelated. Everything's interrelated, and like pool balls, man. You hit one pool ball, hits another pool ball, hits another pool ball. You know, that's how energy works. That's how molecules work. That's the metaphysical world that we live in. So,
Fuck yeah,
pretty cool stuff. Yeah, it's, you know, I'm just glad I'm alive to talk about stuff like this and pass this on. And you know, I've always wondered, you know, why am I still around? Because I've had a lot of near misses, man, in life. I mean, a lot, you know. And I'm like, wow, you know. And I actually was joking one time with this one actress named Marlene Tour. She played on what was it called, Lost, I think, one of the TV shows. She's a Cuban girl, and you know, we're talking on the phone, and I can't remember what we were talking about, but I was telling about some of my life and death experiences. And she's like, "Wow, man, she goes, you're like a cat with nine lives." I go, "No, I'm like a litter of kittens, man, because you know, I should have been dead many, many, many times ago." You know, I said, "Somebody's keeping me around for something," you know, because I should have been out of here. I should have checked out a long time ago. And so I think about my life, right? And so my goal is, I believe that I'm here for a reason. I think partly I'm here for a reason because I have a positive mindset, mm-hmm. and I don't believe I'm supposed to anytime soon.
Yeah.
I believe I have a mission. I have a purpose, and my purpose is to help other people share this information. And you know, it's almost like being a priest, man. You know, kind of preach the gospel, man. You know, and try to save as many people as I can before my time is up.
Yeah.
I got a lot of preaching to do, so I need a lot more time, boss.
That just means we're gonna do a lot more episodes. We're gonna do a lot more episodes because Dale's got to fucking preach.
Yeah, man. It's all good though.
The Sunday sermons at the Church of Comstock.
Yeah, it's gonna get better, man. I got some good stories coming up, you know, and then we'll continue on with my next book. I'm planning to have that done by June. That's my mission.
Fuck yeah.
And still gonna do this one here in audio. I just have to contact that your source there. Mm-hmm. And get that. I've just been really super busy here in Indonesia.
You don't need to explain to me, man. You're good.
Yeah, we got the same drama here as the rest of the world, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, wearing a face mask everywhere, social distancing. It's gotten to like, you know, I mean, you got to wear a face mask in the car. They literally stop you and look in the car. You got a face mask on. You know, it's like, you know, ka-ching, you know, it just gets bad. I'm ready for all this crap to go away. But I'll say one thing, though. Compared to the rest of the world, I really am living in the right place. You know, it's paradise. And even with the mask on, it's still paradise. But the good news is I have a lot more latitude to get things done here. I have more influence, so to speak, because reality is this, man. You can just about pay for anything you need around here, and you can get things done. It's living is inexpensive, but it's just a good place to, you know, and I don't have to the drama that's in the U.S. particularly now, although I do have to deal with it because I have a home there, I have kids there, mm-hmm. and I do go back. But this is a good respite, man, for me here. You can see behind me, I got my swimming pool, you know, my villa, you know, I'm behind 8-foot walls all the way around the house, you know, so it's like my little fortress. And
fuck yeah.
And I'm happy just being hunkered down behind this and just letting the world go by, you know, and just enjoying my time here with my, you know, my wife and kids and stuff. So,
Fuck yeah. So anyways, you've got limitless wisdom, man, and I always appreciate you coming on here, dude. And it's I love listening to it because it's just there's no other time I'm ever going to get this advice from someone with your experiences. And I think you're right. I mean, I think going through this book kind of chunk by chunk is what's needed because it allows. Instead of just reading it, it allows, you know, like you said, it allows, well, one, your voice, but two, you can kind of expand on it. You can bring it to life. You can lean left and right and kind of weave all these other stories into it. And it's fucking, I'm thoroughly enjoying it, man. I mean, I read your book, but this is better than your book is just hearing it from you.
Yeah. It allows for more, yeah, it allows us for a lot more reflection, you know, and deeper thought, you know, and so yeah, it's you know, hopefully, you know, people are inspired, and you know, if nothing else, you know, like I said before, you know, this book's not all about me as much as it's about you. Mm-hmm. And it's not about being a badass, it's about being a good ass. Oh, yeah. And sounds kind of gay or queer, right? But, you know, good ass, you know, like, what does that mean?
You're a good ass.
But, you know, no, it just means, you know, being a good human being, man, a good patriot, good father, good soldier, you know, good citizen, doing the right things. And that makes you a badass, man. And, that's what it's all about.
Fuck yeah. All right. Well, Dale, let's wrap this bitch up. Same time next week, next Sunday, 10 a.m. Eastern.
Yes, sir.
And
all right.
Dale Comstock, American Badass, the book, as always, will be linked in the description, sticky to the top comment, and hopefully sometime, at least in 2021, get that bitch as an audiobook. But
yeah, I'm working on it.
Fuck yeah.
All right, brother.
All right, Dale. God bless. Thank you, as always, man.
Thank you. Take-